Back here on the Mighty 690, it is 7:45, and we have joining us in studio crop agent with the Wildcat Extension District, James Cooper. Good morning, James. How's it going?
Good morning. Doing good.
Very good. So here we are as we've got wheat harvest kind of wrapping up. Kind of a mixed bag out there. The rain timing has been kind of great for the corn, I know, but not great for the wheat situation.
Exactly.
What's the latest?
Yes, it's been good for the corn and not for the wheat. It kind of depends on the location. And so pretty much along the Missouri and the Oklahoma border and even farther out west, you know, wheat harvest has gotten long, a lot farther. I mean, a lot of it has been completely harvested by now, especially around near Coffeyville. There's quite a few fields that have been harvested. I would say, though, there's kind of a strip pretty much right down the middle of my district. From about Chanute almost into Cherokee. There's an area there that they just gotten rain after rain after rain. And you could see that on the accumulation maps. And they have hardly anything harvested yet. So there are a lot of fields out there that are definitely not doing great. There are some issues with a delayed harvest like this.
What are some of those issues when we start to push that harvest further and further back?
Yes. And so some of the issues, it's a number of things. First off, the test weights start to go down. Test weight is like how many bushels or how many pounds you can fit in a bushel. They get light. It's not ideal, really. And so the test weight starts to go down, and that can actually lead to dockage at the co-ops and the ports and all that. And then another issue is shattering, and that's really a problem with the head itself, or the recules. Basically, they drop the kernels, and so there's kernels laying all over the field, and you don't get them in the combine. And so, you know, farmers have to go a lot slower when there's a risk of shattering, or even a storm can basically thrash out the wheat, and you get less bushels. So that's not ideal for delayed harvest. Some varieties are better than others with that. Diseases, of course, because they're just sitting in there. Every time it rains, you know, they get a little bit of moisture inside of that head, and you could end up with some diseases. Sometimes fusarium, which is like the alpha toxin, can get worse. And so it's just one thing after another. Honestly, there's just, you know, we need some sunshine to get that wheat out of the field. Because it doesn't get better.
It seems like it has been a rainy June.
Yes. I mean, you know, we don't... There are some locations that have gotten over 15 inches of rain. And for the last 3 weeks, that is abnormal. Like, we do not get that much rain here. So, it's pretty soggy. And now, of course, there's another round of it coming up here in the next couple of days. I'm hoping by the end of next week, we can get some sun and some wind, which is a weird thing to hope for in June, because we'll be wishing for all this back in July. If we could get some sun, we can get that wheat out, and we can finally get the double crop soybeans in. Because that's another thing, is that the longer we delay wheat harvest, you know, we need to be putting those double crop soybeans right in behind it. And we sure have all over the place. You can see them, at least where they've been able to get into the field.
Have you gotten a chance to get a hold of any of the co-ops to see, you know, kind of what the harvest is looking like yet?
No, I did early when we had a little bit of harvest around the area. And for the most part, everything was looking pretty good. I think yields were slightly above average, but it's hard to determine because I'm getting very anecdotal evidence. And so I don't like to give specifics.
Yeah.
I will say, though, anecdotally, I was hearing about soft wheat in the 80s and 90s. I mean, some of it was over 100, which is really good. Which means the hard wheat, which I hear less about because of the area, it was probably somewhere in the 50s to 60s, which is pretty comparable, honestly. And so, you know, the yields were good. At least the potential for yields were good. And you can kind of tell by looking at those fields, they look nice. But right now, everything is decreasing in time. So rains and storms, I didn't mention this too. Some places have gotten hail pretty bad, and imagine what a hail does. I mean, it's basically like a thrasher of a combine. It just smacks everything, and it tears up corn too, because the corn leaves are big, long, and they're not very strong, so it just shreds them basically.
Do you think we're gonna have a little bit sooner corn harvest with how advanced the crop is?
Yes, most likely. As you could tell, like, it's already filling, really. It's got all the water it needs to finish up. There are some late corn fields, for instance, but for the most part, the vast majority of our corn crop is set. So, oddly enough, that's another reason why we need some more sun, because we need energy to fill those kernels. And so, that really, the more sun, the more yield at this point when it comes to our corn crop as well. So, but yeah, we're definitely going to get that finished up, and those fields will probably sit there for a little bit until we can get the next wheat crop in.
Very good. Well, we'll see where it all goes. Finally, just anything on any disease issues that we've really seen at all?
Nothing abnormal. I guess one thing, and this is for crops but mostly for pastures, is we're keeping a track of the fall armyworm. It was a real issue with last year. So we've got traps out here and there, and we've noticed some influx. And it's early. I mean, fall armyworm shouldn't show up till later, but just like last year, they showed up early. So it's quite possible that they're going to have 3 to 4 generations this year, which means they could be getting a lot worse in the fall, depending on the situation with the rains. So, you know, there are some diseases. As for other diseases like tar spot, or not tar spot, the leaf hopper, the little guy hopping around. We've been watching that. It's an upcoming disease, but it gets here so late. That little guy, I mean, he's hardly even here now, and our corn's almost so far done. So it's the really late-planted corn that we're worried about with the leafhopper guy. But, you know, for the most part, diseases are pretty normal, but they're high just because of the rain. But there's nothing abnormal.
Sure. Well, speaking of rain, it's that time of year for mosquitoes as well. They love this.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit about mosquitoes, and we might...
We can start into it at least.
Yeah. So, you know... This time of year, the mosquitoes are definitely ramping up. I think everybody kind of knows that, and nobody likes them. So, I mean, as much rain as we're getting, they have a thousand different places they could be breeding. And it's logical that they would start about now, because it usually takes about a week in this warm weather for them to start from, you know, pupa or egg all the way to hatching. And so they're already on their next generation, like multiple generations by now, after 3 weeks of wet weather. And they've got literally an entire world to decide where to lay eggs, so they're going to do it everywhere. So really, you know, this little mosquito, getting a hold of control is difficult. I mean, it's one of those things that a lot of people, there's a lot of little things out there to try to help you with control, but a lot of them are not very effective. So I wanted to talk about both the city side and, you know, the individual side as well. So for the cities, you'll notice a lot of them I've already started spraying, the fogging. And what that stuff is usually perithroid, whether it's like some of those Lambda pesticides and some other things. Most of those pesticides, well, actually all of them, have a very low toxicity to mammals, to humans, really, and a pretty low toxicity to birds and other things. The DDT and other bad stuff from the past, we don't use any of that stuff anymore. So most of that stuff is still pretty innocuous. Not that you want to be in it. I mean, obviously you don't want to be fogged. It's not that safe. But still, you know, it's fairly safe for what it is. I mean, it is obviously a pesticide. And so they're gassing this stuff off, whether it's a cold gas or they actually warm it up and create a heated gas for that stuff. You know, the problem is that research has shown it's marginally effective. The problem with citywide fogging is that, A, it's not selective. It kills every bug. And so, I mean, you can't kill a mosquito and not kill ladybugs, right? I mean, there's really nothing to say that. And of course, I mean, you know, so it kills pretty much everything bug-wise that's flying around at that time during the day where they're spreading, usually in the evening when the mosquitoes are out.
And that's killing on contact, right? It's not like getting into the water and messing up the egg cycles or whatever.
Yeah, it actually depends on what they put in there. Because sometimes those fogs will actually have a larval side in there as well. And so they're trying to hope that it actually gets into the larval cycle in the water and do some damage there. I question how effective that is to actually get into the water column and really do anything. But really, you know, it, of course, it kills mosquitoes and some of the other bugs, but also kills the beneficial bugs and the thing that's flying around and actually eating mosquitoes, which is dragonflies. I mean, of all the insects, that's pretty much the only one that's actually doing any decent amount of mosquito control. We'd like to think like purple martins and some of those other birds are really helping with mosquitoes. They don't. I think the research has shown that birds are just too big. And so mosquitoes are way too small, and it's just not worth it for them to catch mosquitoes. They might catch a few, but really they're kind of after bigger game, like moths is really what they're after. So dragonflies is where it's at. And, you know, I've noticed, I'm sure other people have noticed, there's been a lot of dragonflies this year. I mean, they've really uptaked to they also need water to reproduce. They also like the same conditions, and they've got plenty of mosquitoes out there to eat. So, and gnats and other things. So, I mean, I could see the dragonfly population upticking quite a bit, just like they did last year. So, you know, those fogging things, you'll have a temporary control for, you know, a few days, honestly. I guess I don't really know. The research on that hasn't been extensive by any means. But for the most part, what they've seen is you get control for a few days. So, like, maybe before some sort of community festival, they'll fog. But after that, not terribly useful, really.
Sure. I know some cities do it, like, maybe twice a week or something like that during the summer. But, yeah. You know, oftentimes they'll try to do, like, alleys and, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so. They have, you know, specific areas that they're trying to control. Pretty much anything with brush and tall grass, and that's where the mosquitoes like to hide out. But really, it's not very long before mosquitoes from around the area start to come back in. I mean, they're all over the place. And of course, you don't get that great of a control on the little larvae, and it takes 7 days for them from beginning to end. And so within 4 or 5 days, you're going to have a whole new population of mosquitoes come out.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more on mosquitoes here as we continue our Green Setup segment here brought to you by Green Acres in Coffeyville. We've got news coming up here on the Mighty 690. Back here on the Mighty 690, 811, our Green Setup program continues here. James Coover with K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. Good morning, James.
Good morning.
All right, so we were talking a little bit about mosquitoes here in our last segment together, and I know we wanted to continue that discussion here just a little bit as probably going to only be getting worse here as we go throughout the summer.
Yeah. I mean, you know, with as much rain as we've had, more rain on the way, we've just seen the beginning of how heavy the mosquitoes might be. So really, you know, we talked a little bit about what the cities do, the fogging, when it comes to mosquito control, but what can people do? And that's really going to be actually a bigger and more important part of control, honestly, because the city cannot get to every little spot. And everybody kind of knows this part, you have to dump out every water thing that's holding water. Tires are, of course, especially bad at it, and dumping a tire is somehow like physically impossible. I don't know. There's some sort of weird like metaphysics going on there. You can't dump the water out of a tire. It's hard. But so that's where mosquitoes like to be. It's the perfect amount of water for them. Of course, you know, everything from bird baths to buckets to everything gets filled up with water this time of year. And so any kind of junkyard is just going to be absolutely filled. I don't know how you're going to control that, but you know, people with a lot of junk in their yard, they're going to have a lot of mosquitoes in their yard. And usually the more tall grass you have, the more like bushy things around your house, and all that stuff is going to be a harbor for mosquitoes. So getting a control of their larval stage is really the only good option you've got. Yes, you can also use those individual foggers. If you do use that stuff, you kind of want to use it in the bushes around your house. Or anything where they might be hanging out. And of course, if you use them during the evening, basically before, like, let's say you're gonna have a barbecue or something like that before the 4th of July, you wanna fog your yard. Remember, that's very temporary control. I mean, I'm talking like hours long before the neighbor's mosquitoes start coming in. So this is a temporary thing for, keep that in mind when you're trying to plan out your time frame. So They also make those little mosquito dunks. If it's something that you cannot dump out, something much larger you can't dump, you know, those mosquito dunks, they're actually fairly safe for the environment, really. And so a couple of those here and there that might do some good. Ditch culverts, really. A lot of those don't drain very well. Those could be absolutely filled full of mosquitoes. So really, first off, make sure that there are really mosquitoes on there. If it's a place that holds water for long enough, they'll actually start to turn into a place where mosquitoes don't like to live, because it gets filled with frogs and tadpoles and dragonflies and some other things. And now tadpoles, they don't eat mosquito larvae to begin with, because they're too small. But later on, when they start to get a little bit bigger, they'll actually start to eat mosquitoes. So, you know, it really just depends on the biological control. Just take a look. But if you see a whole lot of mosquito larvae, you know, try to get rid of that water as whatever possible.
And what do they actually look like if you can just, when you're actually looking for them? Can you see them very well?
Yeah, I think pretty much everybody. You know, they're just like weird little worms that are kicking around.
Just moving around in there.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I would say tadpoles look kind of similar, actually, to begin with, because they're so small and they're kind of flicking around. But tadpoles, their heads are really big, and so it looks like a little ball with a tail. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, you know, I think most people know a little mosquito kicking around. They're bobbing up and down, really. I have no idea what they eat at that size. I really don't. It must be like little microscopic, you know, algae and other things that they're
probably
that they're
something,
eating.
Yeah.
Something. But you know, so I mentioned it a couple of times is dragonflies. Dragonflies are pretty much our best predator when it comes, as far as I can think of, when it comes to mosquitoes. And you can create dragonfly habitats. Dragonflies, just like mosquitoes, their larval stage is aquatic. However, it's a much longer time frame, and they have more specifications because of that. So dragonflies, they'll stay in their nymph stage, or I mean their, you know, pre-adult stage, for a fair bit longer. I mean, it could be months sometimes, and their nymphs look very different. I mean, they're almost like little underwater spiders, almost like little scorpion guys that live underneath the water. And they're even bigger than a dragonfly sometimes. Like, it seems odd that creature turns into a dragonfly, if you've ever seen them before. And so, and they are very active feeders. I mean, they are predators their entire life. I mean, maybe when they're first born, they're eating other things, but it doesn't take very long before they start taking down. And dragonfly nymphs, the bigger varieties, I mean, they're eating like little fish and tadpoles and really whatever they can get their mouth around. I mean, they'll attack it. And so these little underground or underwater spiders, pretty much flying around and so, or crawling around, the right place for dragonflies, they need a place that is big enough. So they don't like to lay their eggs in anything that's under really about 40 to 50 square feet of water, which is not that big, but they need a bigger spot, and they can kind of recognize when something's not big enough. They also need a right depth, and so about 2 to 3 feet of water is ideal, because a dragonfly, if it's something that's going to dry out before they hatch, they're not going to lay in it. So a small pond can work. If you're going to make a dragonfly habitat, it needs to be a water feature that has a shallow end around, I'd say, 6 inches, and a deep end around 3 feet. And so it transitions from one to the other. And that's ideal for both, like, when they're brand new, like little eggs, and then also when they turn into little nymphs. And so from one side to the other. And a little bit bigger as well. Now, keep in mind, you know, they also like to have some stuff growing in there, like lilies or, you know, tree limbs or something like that, because those nymphs like to hide onto those and sit on them as they wait for their prey. So, you know, they like stuff in there. So, if you imagine what a farm pond looks like. I mean, it's got trees growing in it. It's a big spot. It's got shallow end, deep end. That's sort of what you're creating when you want a dragonfly habitat. you know, and of course, you can't really use chemicals or anything, so it's going to get kind of murky, really. It's going to have some stuff in there. And in the beginning, part of the problem with dragonfly habitats is they start off as mosquito habitats. I don't really know how you can fix that, to be honest with you. I mean, if you fill those up with water and they're 3 feet deep, you can probably pretty easily have, yeah, mosquitoes. And I don't know, it's just part of it. If you creating these water features, they start off as one thing and then later on they can kind of turn into something else. You will end up with frogs in it eventually, you know, and that's not a bad thing. Frogs do their own thing.
Yeah.
But yes, frogs do eat dragonflies. So I don't think that you can really prevent the whole cycle of mosquitoes to dragonflies to frogs. But yes, there will be some frogs in there. And sometimes the frogs are even faster than the dragonflies when they're coming in. But, you know, creating these things, like I said, plenty of plants, the right depth. You need to have water in it pretty much continuously throughout the year. You can drain it during the winter if it's going to damage it in some fashion. But really, it's you're making a little pond, honestly, in your backyard. So dragonflies, how they lay their eggs, dragonflies and damselflies, which is another, they do pretty much the same thing, really. They look pretty similar. So their egg laying can be different. Some of them like to lay all their eggs in one spot, and, you know, it's just like a little clutch of little larvae that come out. Some of the other ones will actually lay their eggs very sporadically all over the place. And you can see that as they're flying along the farm ponds, they like dip their little thorax in. You ever seen that before?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so what they're doing is that she's actually laying eggs as she's going along. And just completely randomly. You think that would be not exactly a logical thing to do. Because what are the chances of that little guy actually surviving in the middle of a pond? I don't know. I guess it's one of those, yeah, hope for the best situations. Laying up eggs and hope for the best. So in creating these water features, one thing is that you can't really put fish in it to begin with. And I don't know that you really can at any point. Because little small fish, they'll be able to eat the larval phase of the dragonfly. Because until they get big enough to actually eat the minnows, I mean, a minnow can eat the dragonfly. So, you know, if you do want a backyard feature with some goldfish, that's totally fine. But don't expect a lot of dragonflies to come from that. So it can be hard to create an actual dragonfly habitat because of those conditions. I mean, you're going to have the mosquitoes to start off with, and then you have these guys, and then you're going to have frogs, which is fine by most people. Well, so
sometimes you just get lucky and nature makes it for you.
Yeah. So for the most part, it's kind of creating a condition where it's, you know, the dragonflies are welcome more than actually trying to create a location. Because outside of if you live in a small acreage outside of town, it's actually pretty easy. But actually inside of town, creating those kind of water features, it takes some real effort. So for the most part, that's really the only natural control of mosquitoes that we can really think about, things to attract some sort of predator. And, you know, there's not a whole lot of things out there that can eat mosquitoes. I mean, just because they're flying around and they're very evasive, they're not very fast. But, you know, it's the control of them has a lot more to do with their larval phage biology than actually controlling when they're in the adult phase. This time of year, of course, there's already so many adults out. So all you can really do is protect yourself. And everybody knows, I mean, baggy clothing, DEET, prethrin, I mean, the spray, you know, and all those other parts to it. There are some things online like, ultrasonic emitters and some other stuff. None of that has been proven to be effective in any fashion. And so for the most part, the most effective traps, the things that actually traps, are the CO2 emitters. And so it's you hook it up to natural gas, like a propane bottle, and they They burn a little bit, they create some heat, and they create some CO2. And that's exactly what it looks like to mosquitoes. That looks like a something to eat. So those actually work fairly well.
Yeah.
And I could see a municipality having a lot better luck with using some industrial size of those in specific locations around town to really trap those mosquitoes.
Just turn them on at night in the evening or something.
Yes. Kind of cool. And so I think that'd be kind of a lot of work, honestly, but I could see those being a more effective long-term thing. They have to be strategic with them because they do, in fact, attract mosquitoes. So you got to be careful. You don't want to end up attracting a lot more mosquitoes than you were getting rid of. But, you know, those things, that is a possibility. The UV lights, they do kind of work. I mean, mosquitoes are attracted to UV light just like all the other bugs. But I think you're just kind of getting a little bit of everything. And it's over a much smaller area of control, honestly. There's just so many lights in town that those UV lights, you get a little bit. Maybe, like, just right where you're sitting. But I'm not really sure. They're going to be more attracted to you than that.
Yeah. Well, some good tips here as we talk about some summer bug control here. And, James, I know you don't really have too many events going on here from the crop perspective. Anything else really going on to tell us about?
No, I should know what the 4-H agents are up to. They're
mostly
always
probably just fair prep at this
point.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, they have a lot of camps, and I know there's some other stuff. I know, Kenny has that floral class, and I really want to join that. He's, I don't know, creating bouquets and some other things. That sounds like a lot of fun, actually. I think he has coming up here in a couple of weeks. But sorry, I should come up with you details. But we know it was before the next Wednesday, so we'll talk about it then.
All right. Well, if folks do have questions for you from a crop perspective here, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Get a hold of me at any of the Wildcat Extension offices. The number for Gerard is 620-724-8233.
All right. That is James Coover here with our Green Setup program here for today. And on the way next, we have Open Line here in just a few minutes.